They are Mexican cartels and criminals.
How the cartels are getting their hands on the
camera. Head of the Sinaloa cartel.
You might have heard about drug cartels. You may even have a concrete audiovisual reference to what a drug lord or a regular narco looks like. But you might have not yet bumped into an attempt to critically deconstruct these categories. Drug cartels, narcos, the drug wars. What do these terms mean? What do they conceal? What is going on behind narratives that in the media portray Mexico as a failed state that is overwhelmed by so-called cartel wars? Today, we will have a conversation with Osvaldo Zavala, author of Drug Cartels Do Not Exist, Narcotrafficking in US and Mexican Culture. Osvaldo is Mexican. He grew up in Ciudad Juárez, a city in the north of Mexico that stands next to El Paso, Texas. Osvaldo began his career as a journalist in his hometown Juárez, but his professional trajectory evolved towards researching post-national imaginaries, representations of violence at the US-Mexico border, and the exhaustion of discourses of modernity in the Latin American narrative of the last two decades. Osvaldo is professor of contemporary Latin American literature and culture at the City University of New York. This interview is divided in two episodes. The first episode, this one, lays down the main arguments of Osvaldo's work on the narco narratives. He will explain how an agenda of national security, originally designed by the United States, influences public policies of security, migration, and energy, not only in Mexico, but even beyond the American hemisphere. In the second part of the interview, which you will find in the next episode, Osvaldo briefly describes the story of the drug wars and reflects on the continuities and changes that Mexico has experienced under President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. You will find references to Osvaldo's books, articles, book chapters, and the work of other authors that Osvaldo mentions during the interview in the description of this podcast. I am your host, Noé Mendoza, PhD candidate at the Department of International Environment and Development Studies of the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. And this is the Political Ecology Forum podcast at NMBU. Osvaldo Zavala, thank you so much for accepting this invitation.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Noé, for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here and to engage in conversation with colleagues from the other side of the world. I'm very very pleased. Somebody who studied part of his graduate work in Europe, I'm always very happy to engage in conversation with colleagues on that side of the planet. So thank you so much for having me.
Let me begin this conversation with one of your main arguments, that drug cartels do not exist, but the trafficking of drugs and the violence are indeed real. How is that combination possible?
One of the central arguments of my last two books is that the word cartel and the idea, the general concept of the drug cartel has become the standardized explanation to account for the experience of violence that Mexico has suffered, in particular from 2006 and on, which is the year that began the military deployment order by then President Felipe Calderon. And the first argument that I want to make in my book is that this concept, drug cartel, and of course the derivatives of this idea, right? The imaginary pyramidal structure of organized crime that has, you know, realms of enforcers and armies and intelligence capabilities, etc. It's part of the general understanding of the so-called drug war that has been articulated by the very institutions pushing for Mexico and Colombia to engage in this idea of anti-drug militarist fighting across the country. And so the concept of the drug cartel not only does not accurately explain the violence that we have experienced in Mexico since 2006, but rather imposes a political understanding of it that in the end is there to legitimize the military operations all over the country, to justify criminal atrocities perpetrated by the armed forces, crimes against humanity, land displacement, dispossession, forced disappearance, extortion, all kinds of other criminal activity that is constantly being blamed on organized crime, but that that in fact has become a phenomenon that is correlated with the very militarization of the anti-drug operations that we have seen since 2006. And so going back to your question, drug cartel as a concept is something that was originally articulated by the official institutions pushing for the drug war, but in no way can explain the rise in homicide that disproportionately affected those very areas where the military deployment happened or has been happening since 2006. And rather, it contributes to a mythology of our understanding of a drug war, of who the traffickers are and what are their activities and what is their reach. And it's in general unverifiable. And yes, the violence is real. And drug trafficking is an important problem, of course, in Mexico. So when I say that drug cartels do not exist, I do not mean by any way that the violence is not happening or that drug trafficking is not an important issue for governance or society in general, but rather that the concept is politically driven, is politically motivated by the institutions pushing us into this idea of a drug war, and that it functions as a legitimizing concept for the militarization. In other words, the idea of the drug cartel functions as a way of creating consensus, right, in society about a common enemy that must be fought, that is out there, and that only that can only be defeated through the deployment of armed forces all across the nation.
I'm very glad that you made this point clear, that the drug trade goes in a different railway than the drug war, because
absolutely.
The drug trade has a materiality that nobody can deny. That is very verifiable, and the violence, yes, as you say, is real. The more than 120,000 homicides that we have had in recent years, and the people disappeared. All that is real. No. At no point in your work you deny that materiality of the phenomenon. The drug war is about a governmentality, a discourse, a creation of consensus. That, I mean, for the audience, I have to say that when I read your books, I completely bought the argument. So I'm trying to extract like what I would understand as like some disturbing facts that you lay, especially in a very nice way in the drug cartels don't exist, and like disturbing facts that make in the mind of the reader possible this dissociation between the materiality of drug trade and the discourse dimension of the drug war. I think for of particular interest for academics and students interested in political ecology, there's this disturbing fact of the correlation between military incursion, the Mexican military going into a communal area or a region, and the violence levels, the historical trajectory before the military, how they change,
right,
the number of homicides, and then the phenomenon of extractivism, and very much linked to mining, but mostly energy. Energy extractivism.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on that, because I think that's a very disturbing fact that allows one to understand that drug trade and drug war can go in very different directions.
Absolutely. So precisely because we tend to conflate, right, the history of the drug trade and the history of the drug war as one thing, and we trying to, and I think methodologically mistakenly, try to find consequence or causality between, you know, the organizations of the drug trade and the violence and the multiple effects that this violence has had in Mexico, right? So we tend to believe that the traffickers, you know, kept growing their organizations and became very powerful, so much that, you know, they ended up being at war with each other, right? And this is the official explanation for the violence, right? That cartels in different parts of Mexico are growing their territory and their ambition for turf control, and they're always fighting among themselves. And this explains the rise in homicide. However, official verifiable data tells a very different story, right? From 1997 until 2007, Mexico actually saw a sustained reduction in the homicide index, right? So 1997 was one of the most violent years, I believe, with the murder index of somewhere around 20 killings per 100 inhabitants. So actually less than that. I think it's more like 15 killings for 100 inhabitants. But by the time we reach 2007, the national murder rate is around 8 killings or 9 killings per 100 inhabitants, which is a very standard rate for most developed countries, right? And very comparable to that of cities all over the United States, right? Even Ciudad Juarez, right, my own hometown, had a murder rate of about 9.5 killings per 100,000 inhabitants. Once again, not a very different scenario for a border town, a border city with industrialized issues and with all kinds of I guess lacks and deficits, right? All kinds of difficulty with a growing population and an influx of migrants and the different labor forces that have all kinds of precarity living standards in the border. But with the militarization, that sustained reduction in violence was broken, interrupted, right? So the militarization began roughly around early 2007 in different parts of the country, and it gradually was expanded all across Mexico. So by the time it reached my city, Ciudad Juarez, we went from about 300 killings that were registered in 2007 to over 1,300 in 2008, right? And by the time we reached 2010, there were over 3,000 killings, right? A very disproportionate, very scandalous rise in homicide. There have been ever since multiple studies done by academics in Mexico or the United States demonstrating there is a direct correlation, right? A correlation between the armed forces deployment and the rise in violence in those exact cities and regions where the military presence was deployed. And if you then follow the effects of this decades-long militarization, you would find that it also coincides with many sites of energy extraction, right? As you mentioned, one of the key examples that we can offer is the case of the state of Tamaulipas in the north east of the country, right by the Gulf of Mexico. We have one of the largest gas reservoirs for the hemisphere, even larger than some of the basins in the southwest of the United States. And so what you have is, especially during the militarization for supposedly for drug operations, you would have at the same time the development of extractive projects and extractive industry, right? So you have plenty of transnational organizations like BP, Chevron, Sempra Energy, interested in exploring and extracting natural gas in the area, right? So you had on one hand the narrative that the drug trade was out of control, that they were killing people and controlling turf for the sake of the routes of drug trafficking to the United States. But at the same time, you had very skilled and effective energy projects ongoing in the area. For example, they lay out one of the largest pipelines in the history of Mexico in those very years, in 2010, 2011. That continued all to the late years of the Peña Nieto government in 2016, 17, and 18, and this pipeline it crosses basically the entire nation, you know, throughout precisely the most conflicted zone. So one doesn't really understand how is it possible, right, that energy projects of this magnitude can happen, right, while the country is supposed to be at war, fighting the drug trade. And so what is very interesting, and this is the work, I'm following here the work of journalists and academics who have thought of this link, is that the drug war narrative seems to be masking illegal land displacement, violent forced disappearances, controlled population, and of course, the resistance of any militant activism, right, for ecological or simply land rights, and that with this violence, you know, masked as a drug war, they've been able to clear the land, right, and being able to facilitate the construction of these projects. Also, we must understand that guiding both the drug war narrative and the extractive industry, you have plenty of government officials, right, from past governments who in Mexico, who through this revolving door have ended up serving in boards of multinational corporations, right, that are interested in the extractive industry. And so there is a clear link between military violence, state-sponsored violence, and the development of energy projects in places like Tamaulipas, in the state of Chihuahua, the state of Sonora, the state of Guerrero, Michoacán, etc. Right, and I have done this in my last book, I offer some evidence about this. If you interpose the map of violence and the map of energy extraction, you will find out that most of the times those sites coincide, you know, almost with dramatic accuracy. And as they do, then we need to ask ourselves how much of what we've been told is the war on drugs has really masked and hidden for us a process of accumulation that David Harvey famously called accumulation by dispossession, right? The process of using friendly armed forces to clear communal lands, to mitigate ecological resistance, local resistance, and to basically force people out of their rights to land, to water, to resources for the benefit of multinational corporations.
Yeah, I believe there's also a book chapter that you entitled Dispossession by Militarization, right? Forced Displacement, mm-hmm, and the Neoliberal Drug War. So yeah, all these references, they will be in the description of the podcast for the audience if they want to further read more about these arguments and the evidence that is supporting these arguments. Yeah, I remember now that you were talking, explaining the case of Tamaulipas, I remember some episodes in the Narcos Netflix series where they depict the so-called war between El Chapo armies and the Zetas cartel, right. And you get to see like the fighting with tanks and guns in the streets, but you don't get to see the engineers working in the pipeline. And one has to...
which is a simultaneous reality, right? Something that is happening right at the same moment, right? And what is really interesting about this is that, you know, the geopolitical push to make the drug war happen was simultaneous to the efforts to open the energy industry in Mexico, both push by different U.S. Institutions and political actors, right? Let's not forget, for example, that during the Obama administration, the State Department under Hillary Clinton commissioned people specifically to facilitate the energy reform that took place in 2013 that allowed for the insertion of a private investment in gas and electricity and oil, right? And as this process is happening, President Obama is also very openly supporting the drug war, calling President Calderon a hero for the Mexican people, funding the militarization with the Merida Initiative, an aid package that gave over $3 billion in training and equipment, and also with the constant political, binational, diplomatic support of multiple state actors from the border region, right? So you had Republican and Democratic governors supporting and welcoming the militarization of the country, helping with all kinds of training facilities, and just generally backing, right, the violence that was instigated against the most vulnerable people in Mexico, and this is something that also we must keep in mind, right? That what we've been told has been the sinister product of this war is completely wrong, right? This we've been fed the idea that traffickers are fighting and that there are, you know, these organizations with almost military capability killing themselves. But if you look at the official data on the victims of this so-called war, what you will find is that in average, the victim of the militarization has been brown, young, uneducated men who were born and died poor in the outskirts of the largest cities in Mexico. So this is a very targeted and very efficient killing of poor people in Mexico. Right. Not, of course, in a random violent gunfight that we see in TV series or film, but you have a very, very focalized product of bloodshed, right, and destruction that has been disproportionately affecting the most vulnerable. So you could say, like other journalists and academics, like for example Alexander Avina, a historian in the University of Arizona, or political scientist Guadalupe Correa, George Mason University, or journalists like Canadian Don Paley or Italian Federico Mastroianni, all will tell you this is a war against the poor. So not so much even a war, but the extermination of the poor, right? My friend and investigative journalist Ignacio Alvarado refers to this very clearly as social cleansing, right? And so it is very important to guide our reasoning, right, with this data, right, and not with the mythology that is easily attributed to drug organizations.
Now, I'd like to, yeah, a bit related to this last thing you're saying, I'd like to move to a bit of a more academic question, although we might fall into a bit of jargonitis. Because when you're talking about this social cleansing, I think that's like the, let's say, like the materiality behind the biopolitics of this discourse. So in the book, I'm thinking now particularly on the book Drug Cartels Don't Exist, you argue that what we have experienced in the present century in Mexico is probably, I'm quoting here, the most aggressive program of biopolitics in Mexican modern history, end quote. So you're, as you just said, you're relying on the work of journalists like Don Paley, Federico Mastroianni, other academics. And I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more on how you understand power and the state, keeping in mind always that there's a difference between the drug trade and the drug war as a discourse or a narrative. I make this question because in your books, I find that your epistemic foundations are some sort of like a combination of post-structuralist Foucault style and neo-Weberian understandings of power. Because on the one hand, I see in your texts the concept of biopolitics, which is usually founded on the idea that power is diffuse, that there is not like a single actor or a set of actors are holding power. Power is more like pervasive in society, flowing, operating in invisible ways. And that's like the post-structuralist bit. But also, you use the argument of depicting this social cleansing as a state of exemption, and that
right.
The Mexican state is pushing, for example, this energy policy, which otherwise might find the opposition from below. So that puts, I find in that argument more like a neo-Weberian conception of power. Like I see the Mexican state behind. So
right.
That's where I get, I mean, a bit confused in a way, but I see how you can combine post-structuralist and neo-Weberian conceptions of power. But I would like to hear it from you. How do you combine these two understandings of power and the state?
Right. Well, because I believe they must be combined to really fully understand what goes on with violence in Mexico. And this I think would take me first to understanding the idea, for example, how hegemony works. Right. If you look at Gramsci's original conception of hegemony as the manufacturing of consents, you don't only have the spontaneous acceptance of hegemonic narratives, there's also a component of coercion and violence, right? Gramsci insisted on this, right? Hegemony is not just the result of, you know, a constructed subjectivity that we all accept spontaneously through the different enforcers, right? The family, church, etc. But there's also a violent coercion aspect to it. Right, hegemony doesn't just happen because we all, you know, are persuaded by false subjectivity and ideology, but also by that very material explicit moment when somebody beats you, right? and so between that duplicity or that dichotomy, right, of hegemony, right, consent and violence, I think I drew an idea of how the drug war as a narrative was deployed in Mexico. On the Foucauldian side, yes, there is the construction of subjectivity through that circulates, you know, a dominant narrative of war, right? If you look at the Foucault, for example, from Society Must Defend It, from Biopolitics, you do get the idea that sovereignty is not something exercised from the top down, right? As he would consistently try to criticize. But rather, you know, also the construction of subjectivity of a naming of society that, you know, collectively it can be manipulated or led, right, in a very hegemonic way. On the other hand, you do have the very decisionist intervention of the state, and I'm thinking Weberian, but also you know, Schmittian, right? I'm thinking here a lot in Carl Schmitt and the idea of the decisionist state making very clear attempts of violence guided from state structures. And sovereignty, of course, is for me a very important word that is not easily reconcilable with my Foucauldian formation, and I understand that, but but that if you look at even at Michel Foucault's idea of war, I think in many ways can be conversant, right? So my I am conscious that what I'm trying to do here is to make a functional, I guess, theoretical understanding of state violence based on those two components, right? The construction of general subjectivity that makes this circulation of a narrative of a drug war more acceptable and instrumentalizes that consent to legitimize the militarization. But at the same time, you need the decisionist intervention of the state to facilitate and to advance the interests of this discourse and discursivity. So even if aspects of Foucault's thought is not exactly reconcilable with this, I believe that that in practice, what you do have is the very powerful intervention, not just of the Mexican state, but of the transnational work of U.S. institutions in Mexico that has simultaneously manufactured the subjectivity of the drug war, creating consensus not just in Mexico, but also in the U.S. And in the planet in general. So much, for example, that nowadays you have reproductions of the idea of the drug war mentality in countries far away from the hemisphere, right? You have a new drug war happening, for example, in Argentina, where, you know, the Argentinian trafficker MAST is being portrayed pretty much in the symbolic coordinates of the Mexican narco, and that has been used to increase the presence of violent state forces for social control, right? You have the same thing happening in the Philippines. You have the same thing happening in Spain, in different parts of the Asia, of course, and Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And so this mentality doesn't just happen, you know, through the Foucauldian idea of you know, of subjectivity and sovereignty disseminated or dispersed in the people, but also with the top down intervention of institutions and militarist projects, right? And maybe the way that I reconcile this is that by the state, I do not mean always, you know, the executive power of the presidency, but I mean the accumulation of different institutions that that involve governance, but also the circulation of arms, of binational agreements, diplomacy, NGOs, and the multiple institutions and actors that support a state governmentality. Right. And so here I'm thinking, of course, with the idea that the state in itself, it must be understood as a combination of multiple institutions acting in its name, but to advance multiple interests that are not always those of the ruling political class, but also those of transnational businessmen and global interests. And here I sometimes think, for example, of the marvelous work done by journalist and activist Jeff Halper, right, who wrote this extraordinary book, War Against the People, who brings to our attention the fact that our global conflict experience in countries like Mexico or Colombia perhaps have a genealogy that begins in the Israeli-Palestine conflict, right? And the idea that one country, you know, exerts totalized control in a population under the false flag narratives of, you know, terrorism and insurrection, and that has replicated and brought immense business opportunities and political power to different regions of the world. In the U.S.-Mexico border, I think the work of reference there is the book Empire of Borders by journalist Todd Miller, who follows the links of global money in the sale of weapons and securitizing the border and bringing new technology to the U.S.-Mexico border, and the extraordinary budget that is spent in security throughout the continent, right? So if you follow all that lead, right? So you have, like, once again, the combination between a false subjectivity, right? The idea of the narcos out there doing these things, but also at the same time, those very same institutions intervening materially and directly violently in countries like Mexico.
No, the way now that I'm, as we are talking now, how I understand this combination of post-structuralist approach to power with a more classic idea of sovereignty. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the post-structuralist bit is very useful to understand how the consensus is working nowadays.
Right.
But the more traditional idea of sovereignty is very useful to reveal how that consensus was introduced by state structures. And I think there's another disturbing fact that is actually quite illuminating in this sense, which is the circularity between how journalists report on the phenomenon and which is very annoying, because after reading your book, like now that I, as I read or hear the opinions of people that I respect a lot, like Sergio Aguayo, journalists like Ernesto Cedillo, like they are citing sources from the military, which are unverifiable, and that sociologists like Fernando Escalante have demonstrated that the press communication or the press drafts from the Ministry of Defense are sort of like taken out of how would you say, a machote, like a standardized format, a template, and it's but everyone is citing the same sources. So this circularity of journalists talking about cartels because they are citing sources from the government, and the government talks about these things that are unverifiable. I can see that as a way of maybe concealing that the consensus is real, is flowing, but the original inception comes from the state and this agenda of national security, which
absolutely.
Now that you, as you were pointing also as like the importance of not mixing the phenomenon or the materiality of the drug trade with the governmentality of drug war, I'm also sort of understanding that the sovereignty of the state is in the discourse of the drug war. Maybe not necessarily, they don't need to control the violence and the trafficking. Maybe they do in some parts, but that's not the point. What they need to control is the discourse. Is that a correct interpretation?
Absolutely. And what is very interesting to understand is that this control is so effective that that it brings a perception of the violence that is almost automatically signified in the coordinates of the drug war. And this happens not just to the people perceiving the news and reading about this, but as you mentioned, to the very journalists covering the stories, right? And just the field itself of security studies, you know, in academia and the way it is portrayed in journalism has commanded a very clear understanding of what goes on in Mexico. So if you're interested in covering violence in Mexico, then what you will need to cover is drug traffickers, right? And try to understand what the drug traffickers are doing and who and where they are located and how is it that we cannot win this war. That is in itself the narrative of the state, right? It's what like James Scott would say, seeing like a state, right? Mm-hmm. And so here we're following the coordinates of the national security agenda set forth by those very institutions conceiving originally the drug war. And so journalists, also because of their proximity to official sources, very easily fall into this trap, right? They come, for example, foreign correspondents, but also domestic journalists covering these issues come to areas of conflict with already a prearranged understanding of what is going on and what they're about to see. So if they witness some gunfight or some form of disturbance, they immediately assume that it has to be one group fighting another, or that some form of criminal insurgency taking place, right? They are trained already to follow the coordinates and the narrative of the state. And not only that, sometimes directly the information they produce is fed by official sources, right? So you have plenty of correspondents who would quote disproportionately official sources to explain the violence, to account for the violence. And then when they try to do field work, a new phenomenon arises, right? The fact that a lot of the actors, the non-state actors participating in this violence also believe the same narrative, right? So you would find, for example, low-level traffickers thinking that they are, in fact, in some form of epic war against other traffickers, right? Even though statistically, you know, they're the ones dying alongside people who have pretty much nothing to do with the drug war, or people who have no form of empowerment or agency, right? And that are disproportionately at the mercy and the power of the military. So there's a very effective circularity of discourse that transcends all the different actors and people involved in securing this narrative, including the traffickers themselves.
This is the end of episode 1 of the interview with Osvaldo Zavala by Noé Mendoza in the Political Ecology Forum podcast at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences.